Namaste and Happy Earth Day. Over the year, we have collaborated with visionaries and experts who have enhanced our discussions and expanded our perspectives on environmental sustainability and stewardship. At PEI, Earth Day 2024 is about expanding the conversation surrounding the environment to include and highlight the narrative of climate change, energy, and sustainable development. So for today's episode, we are rebroadcasting a conversation between PEI colleague Soumitra Nyopani and Ajay Dixit on risk and resilience, climate change, loss and damage, and the future of Nepal's development pathway. The second of a two-part series, this discussion explores Nepal's ambitious net zero emission goals and the impact of climate change on Nepal's water, energy, and infrastructural development. They also discuss the transboundary nature of the water relationship in the region and how climate change can perturb the existing interdependencies. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Namaste and welcome to Pods by PEI, a policy discussion series brought to you by Policy Entrepreneurs, Inc. My name is Tedon Konsakar. This episode is part two of the conversation between Soumitra Nyopani, Executive Director of Policy Entrepreneurs, and Ajay Dixit. Ajay is the co-founder and advisor at the Institute for Social and Environmental Transition, ISED Nepal. He is an Ashoka Fellow and a leading voice in Nepal and internationally on issues of climate change adaptation, resilience building, and disaster risk management. In the previous episode, Soumitra and Ajay discussed the outcomes of COP27 and how climate change impacts countries like Nepal and the Himalayan region. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, we highly recommend that you do so. In this episode, Soumitra and Ajay discussed the plausibility of Nepal reaching its ambitious goal of net zero emission by 2045 and the impact of climate change on Nepal's water, energy, and infrastructural development. They also discussed the transboundary nature of water relationship in the region and how climate change can perturb the existing interdependencies. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome back to part two of my discussion with Ajay Dixit. So Ajay, we left our earlier discussion on Nepal's policy architecture and climate change. Continuing on that discussion, Nepal has set a vision, at least on paper, for a long-term strategy for net zero emission by the year 2045. What does this actually mean?
First of all, I think we are part of the global community. Our prime minister went to Glasgow last year and then, of course, said, you know, by 2045, Nepal would be net zero. That's in tune with many commitment made by many other countries. You know, India has said it will be 2070, China, others. The basic idea, you know, in a simple term is that how much we emit the greenhouse gases through whatever sources within our territory would be equal to how much we absorb. That is in a very simple terms what net zero means, at least within our territory, right? So we have to, yes, the commitment has been made. So we are almost end of 2022. So 2023 is, you know, a month away. So the journey should begin now. Journey should get to that end. 2025 should start now.
So in a sense, this means that by 2045 or 2045, we will absorb whatever carbon is being emitted in Nepal.
Yeah, that's the idea. So therefore, we have to ask the question, okay, what are the sources of carbon? Transportation, deforestation, industries, they do generate some. Livestock, construction activities, cooking, heating, whatsoever little that we do. Of course, we must emphasize that globally, the amount of carbon that we emit is minuscule compared to others. That I think we should emphasize, right?
Yeah, but reading through the document, I mean, even for a low emission country like Nepal, and this is a strong message by Nepal and a good step forward to say that by 2045, we're going to go to net zero emission. No country, I think, in South Asia has made that commitment. But reading through the document, I picked up on a few things and started to question the plausibility of Nepal meeting this target by 2045. It was quite clear that business as usual, as you said, is not going to suffice. You have to start now, and we are already falling behind. And the point that really stuck out for me was that the document identified an investment requirement upwards of $200 billion to meet the 2045 net zero emission. Can you tell our audience what is that pathway that is being laid out in the long-term strategy to reach where we want to?
We talked about finances in the beginning, Soumitra. The conversation on climate change has been importance of technology, particularly renewable technology, from petroleum or fossil fuel based to non-carbon generating energy sources, and including in the larger ecosystem. And then that developing countries need financial support to make that transition. That cannot happen without regular ODI support that we get, because it is addition, including the impact that the climate change incurs on our socio-political landscape. So that's been a conversation of climate discourse. Now, this finance is important, but I think finance is also means to an end. Finance should help us achieve those ends. Let's also look at other impacts of emissions that we do. Air pollution, indoor air pollution, that has strong GHG component, particularly for women and children. Reliance on biomass for steel cooking. Import of petroleum, for example. Import of petroleum for running cars and transportation is keep on going. So therefore, we also, in addition to climate, we have other imperatives that demands us to sort of move into that trajectory. So where do we begin? So let me try to share with our listeners one barrier that we need to address. Say the replacement of liquefied petroleum gas by electricity.
So this is the energy unit that we use to make food at home.
Exactly, LPG. Cooking. You know, there are extensive policy by Government of Nepal, 9 policies which sets out how that transition will happen for clean cooking. So everything is fine. You know, we have electricity, and then of course we could cook. But then if you go into underneath the surface, you come out with number of, you know, barriers. The first of all is that the majority of the consumers use low ampere connections.
Is this conversation in line with what the government came out in the recent budget to subsidize
induction cookers
and stuff?
There is provision for induction cooker subsidies. There are whole kind of commitments politically. That's fine. But that underneath, the structural problem are serious. So the majority of the consumers have 5 ampere connections. And if everyone uses cooker at the same time, you know, the power is just going to go up. And then we have the leadership of Nepal Electricity Authority saying our system cannot bear that peak load. So we need transformation of the existing transmission and distribution system, the wiring system at home. From 5 ampere, you have to go to 15 ampere. So therefore, while the political commitments, the policy provisions, etc., are welcome, you know, there are these barriers that we need to address. For example, somebody, you know, has to go out of home at 10 o'clock and his food has to be ready. If the electricity doesn't come, of course, you know, the reliability is a problem. So the NEA again says, under this condition, we cannot assure reliability. So therefore, you know, much depth work is needed to identify barriers. The political economy, for example, if you will. And then, of course, how do you improve reliability? How do you improve these systems from where we are to where we are? Things are improved, but those are the challenges that we need to think
about. Just on the issue of cooking, so post-budget, when the government announced subsidies for induction cookers and stuff, so some of us were discussing and diagnosing how this would be implemented. And as you rightly pointed out, the connection that people have at home across Nepal, most of those connections will not support induction cookers. So the government might be distributing that hardware, induction cook stoves, but people would not be able to actually plug it in and then run it to cook food. So our point of interest there was maybe the subsidies should have been targeted towards rewiring people's homes so that they could fetch and start cooking with induction cookers. Just on that note, I mean,
I think it's proven that using electricity is cheaper.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's cheaper than using LPG. You know, those evidence exist. There is a commitment, at least in a sort of a political rhetoric, there is a commitment. But I think in order to move to that future, you've rightly pointed out that the targeting has to be different. The thinking has to be perhaps what we can say outside the box. Normal business as usual, you know, isn't going to help us.
So the takeaway here then is, as with everything else, even for the long-term strategy to reach net zero emission by 2045, we've got good things lined up, at least on paper, but all of that will come down to how it is going to be implemented.
And I think other important point is to tracking it, Soumitra. As I said, you know, the journey has to begin now. We must be demonstrating that, you know, this is the emission and this is what we have in 2023, in 2024, in 2025. And by that 2030, perhaps we need to demonstrate that, yes, indeed, these other changes do take us to the path of, you know, achieving net zero by 2045. We can't start it in 2035. You know, it's just about 23 years left.
Excellent. Ajay, now I want to move the conversation to a topic of interest for both of us, water and energy, something that we are both invested in. And this is kind of also drawing from the long-term strategy, which identifies energy and the transition in energy that we just talked about to be really critical in Nepal's development pathway and how it deals with climate change. But interestingly, Nepal's water resources in the context of climate change looks like presents both risks and opportunities. On one hand, you observe increasing incidence of water-induced disasters, floods, droughts, the melting of the Himalayas. At the same time, you see a strong policy impetus on, especially from the government side and significant private resource investments also, on hydro-based renewable energy development and electrification. So Nepal's water resource sector comes across as being a double-edged sword. How do you see this issue in the climate discourse?
This is an interesting question, Soumitra. I do a lot of conversation with people of different disciplines, different sectors. I also talk with people who are directly involved in these different dimensions. I mean, we all do. Clearly, in climate change, we say mitigation is gas, adaptation is water. Because the impact manifests through change in the hydrological cycle. The energy balance changes because of extra gas in the atmosphere, the sun's energy, and that has impact on the weather system and the energy in the atmosphere. So the impact comes through water, change in the hydrological cycle as we know it. That's the atmospheric story, if you will. But then again, hydrology has changed because of our own interventions. The U.S. United States Geological Survey has just brought out an image which talks about changed hydrological cycle. It's not what it used to be 100 years ago. Having said that, how does that impact, how does that change manifest? How does that directly impact, for example, hydropower project? We need to, again, look at our diverse river system. We need to look at rivers that come from snow. We need to look at rivers that don't come from snow because the hydrology of these rivers are very, very different. Now, one impact would be changes in the flow. Less flow, less energy. More flow, perhaps more energy. But more flow is during the monsoon. And more flow also means floods. More flow also means landslides. More flow also means damage to the infrastructure, dams and barrage and, you know, the appurtenance. And then, of course, the transmission and distribution system. The pylon is washed away. The headwork is washed away. The system gets disrupted. We have this example in Bhotikosi 2014, you know, many other sites. I've talked with some of the developers who have hydropower plants in the smaller rivers, in the rain-fed rivers. And what they tell me is that the energy production or the flow of river is not what it used to be 20 years ago. So they experience lower energy generation. So that's the developer story. When you go to the regulators, when you go to the government agency, they say, well, we don't have that evidence. You know, we don't have that evidence that the flow has really gone down. So that evidence has to come. So we really can't attribute that climate change is having impact on hydropower. My question to them was, are you considering hydropower risk? And they say, no, there is no evidence. So the question therefore is, you know, we need more evidence. We need to look at how the energy generation of these plants have, for example, changed or not changed in the last 20 years.
It's just a question on evidence, and that was a question that I was going to pose to you. You've been studying the sector from the early 90s or even before that. You're an engineer yourself. And the evidence, while really scanty and probably it's not scientifically established to be attributed to climate change, but there is evidence around projects being hung dry in the sense that there was a group of 50 developers that petitioned the government that the projects could not be operated well due to faulty hydrology. Part of that problem could be how estimates were done. Hydrological estimates were done, but it could also be the fact that the estimates that were done do not hold true today. How do you see that issue?
That's one of the factors is true. You know, as we talked about, you know, we have a limited database. Some of the rivers are not monitored. So we don't have enough length data that would give us a reliable estimate of what the flow would be at different probabilities. That's one part. Other part is, what is the link between, for example, those who collect flood data, flow data, which is the official DHM, and these hydropower sector? You know, what is the interlinkages? What is the quality of data that's collected? What is the quality of design that is collected? The technological dimension, for example, are there cutting corners? Who monitors? Who regulates? How do you ensure quality? Those are very important points that also needs to be asked. And this particular example that you stated, I think, tried to cover all those, but there was also a political dimension that there were efforts to scuttle, if you will, you know, some of the, you know, regulatory requirements.
So, Ajay, I've done two previous episodes on hydropower, with one with Satish Joshi and one with Sagar Prasai. And at PEI, we are trying to better understand what this means. And the line of thought that we have been exploring as part of our podcast and our own research is this re-examination of a grand narrative of hydro-led prosperity in Nepal. It's been there since the very early days and stuff. So what I wanted to really engage you on is this idea of climate change and how big a risk it is for that hydro-led prosperity that is widely discussed in Nepal. Is this something for us to take caution now and reorganize ourselves, or is this too less of a concern at the moment and then we just keep on rolling as it is?
You know, we could say, oh, this is alarmist, so therefore we don't care. All right, that could be one approach, but I think that's not the right approach. If you do take that route, maybe, you know, 10, 15 years from now, we're going to be left with lots of sort of stranded assets in the hills where we build these plants and then they don't function as designed. But I think let me get back to, you know, the early times, you know, when we started, for example, in the 80s. And you rightly said, you know, we have this grand narrative where we think, you know, hydropower is the only resource that we have that we can develop. When we started, the idea was that we have so much water. You know, this Nepal is a water-rich country. And we even go to the extent of saying we are second to Brazil. You know, how did that...
Clearly, that's not true.
I don't know why that narrative came. You know, you would rather be first. Why would we be second? That's the narrative that emerged. And everyone said, we are second to Brazil and all that. And then, of course, if you look at the early conversation, it was all about projects. It was all about projects, developing a hydropower dam, as if they were ending themselves. Hydropower produces energy, hydro energy, and that energy is input to the production process. You know, you use that energy to use in manufacturing, service sector, agriculture, etc. That's the trajectory of how hydropower developed in many, many developed countries, you know, United States, Canada, others. But for us, that became the end in itself. And we never considered hydropower to be part of this larger socioeconomic transformation of the country. I'll tell you, 2 days ago, there was a interesting news. The interesting news and the title was Slump in Power Use, Sign of Economic Woes.
Oh, this is for Nepal?
This is for Nepal. All right. We had heard that after the monsoon, the river flow goes down, and then, of course, the power plants produce less energy. That was the conversation till about 2-3 years ago. What we hear is because the economic activities have slowed down, you know, there is no consumption of energy that we have, right? And then you look at, okay, what's happening in the industrial front. And then, of course, the FNCCI and others say that the consumer demand is not going up. We can't take a loan. Interest rate is a problem. So this is a very different conversation that has emerged when you think about energy, when you think about the idea of prosperity. Simply having more energy, building more plants and having more energy is not automatically leading you to the kind of prosperity that we think. Cooking in Nepal generated hydropower, replacing petroleum products with hydropower, all the rest of it. That's not automatically going to happen. We talked about barriers to clean cooking. You have similar barriers to adoption of electric vehicles or public transport system. Not that it's a clean system. Things are happening, but perhaps not on a transformative scale. And then, of course, we are now exporting energy, and we're also importing energy. So the landscape of energy has become much more complex from what we started by saying, oh, yeah, we'll build projects and we'll generate more energy and things would be all hunky-dory. No, that's not going to happen. So I think there has to be a new thinking. People have to be more engaged and looking at what's happening in the landscape. The ministry, DOED, the regulator, ERC, IPAN, economist. This energy thing has to be part of our larger economic transformation agenda and that conversation, you know. And also, let's look at the other dimension. You know, we are a people exporting country, if I make it more dramatically. 65 lakhs of Nepali youths are outside. So energy, thinking it differently, could create jobs for us, right? Now, simply by establishing industry is not going to happen. You know, it has to be thought through. It has to be competitive. It has to be linked to the global commodity chain. What is our comparative advantage? You know, what can we do? How do you link that? These are some very, very fundamental questions that we need to begin to ask if you think about this idea of prosperity. And let me end by saying this, you know, of course, hydro is also water. If you had simply renewables and if you had simply gas or coal or others, of course, they have their own externality. But hydro is also water. And water has multiple functions and multiple use, right? So that's something that we also can't forget. If I look at one policy, there is a provision of what we call environmental flow.
This is maintaining...
Maintaining minimum flow in the river, downstream of the dam. My research and, you know, my conversation with a lot of people who work on ecology says none of the dam maintain that value. None of the dam release that water. So therefore, Soumitra, you know, we have to do things differently. We have to do things differently in designing, in producing, in addressing risk, in using, and addressing the other externalities. The business as usual just will not take us forward.
Ajay, as you were speaking, just another tangential thought came into my mind, and I'm thinking out loud here. So since history, there's been this conversation saying that the type of hydropower that is dominating in Nepal, in the sense we have run-of-river projects, where water is not stored and then you just let the river flow and then that runs the turbine. And that has certain limitations of seasonality. When the river dries up, then your production also dries up. That kind of created a need for building storages, which we haven't. But there is enough conversation in town about how do we really add to our energy security through building large storages. There is a conversation of Puri Gandaki. But looking at it from a climate change perspective, there is already evidence that storage projects lead to a lot of emission of carbon. So
methane.
So in that sense, is there a way to rebrand what we thought was our shortcoming in the sense around free river projects, in some avoided cost principle, saying that we could have built 1200 megawatts of storage plant that would emit X amount of methane, and we've avoided that emission of methane
by replacing
it with storage projects and then get financing with projects. Is that a plausible?
Well, that would be a complex complex mathematics. You know, how much we emit and how much carbon we replace in the induced domain, wherever that is, might be across the border. That will be within ourselves. But large scale hydropower projects have other externalities too. They have other risks, even if you don't consider climate change. Number one is the sedimentation. I mean, we had one reservoir, which is Kulikhani. In 1993, there was a massive cloudburst in the river's watershed, and that brought in almost about 5 million cubic meters of sediment. So therefore, that's one. Other one, it inundates or submerges our valley. It causes involuntary displacement. And these rivers also produce what we call regulated flow. And all these rivers flow downstream to India. So many of these proposed projects, Karnali, Kosi, others, have been on the sort of, you know, cooperative agenda of Nepal and India for a long time. Something that two countries haven't agreed is on the principle of downstream benefits. Yeah. So it becomes a kind of a, you know, free rider. So that cost will also have to be accounted for. You know, we had a huge debate in the 90s globally about dams. Those debates have kind of subsided. But then again, you know, climate change perhaps offers opportunities to revisit those debates. The other question is, you know, we're talking about snow melt. We're talking about changes in the snow dynamics. How does that alter the river hydrology as we come down? What does it mean for the envisaged storage? Would drought be exacerbated like we have, for example, in some of the Western Europe reservoirs? Will our reservoirs be empty or our reservoirs will be full? You know, those are the questions. Perhaps at least we need to begin to look at the scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then what does a particular scenario mean in terms of, you know, the risks to investment? So those are, again, as I said, these are not simple questions. These are not questions that have silver bullet answers, but these are issues that really need to look at studies, research, conversation. That's the landscape we have to go and visit.
I think very true. In the sense, I also tend to feel that the way we kind of build our perspective around what kind of energy we are to develop through our hydropower resources, not being against developing hydropower, but it's definitely not clean and green and climate friendly as it is widely publicized. I mean, there are inherent risks and challenges of building hydropower. And then we should be more considerate and start thinking through or at least conversing on some of these issues.
Absolutely. I mean, once you complete it, of course, it has its other costs and so on and so forth. At least once you build it, water is renewable. So therefore, the generation is perhaps carbon neutral once you complete that. But the construction itself is carbon incentive. We invest in constructing a hydropower project. The cement, the rebars, everything is based again on burning of carbon. So therefore, if you take a life cycle consideration, you know, perhaps the story is a little bit different. But then again, it's much better than if you minimize the, you know, social and environmental externalities, if you consider those factors into the, you know, into the designing and planning process, perhaps we could consider it to be less polluting than the, you know, coals and other sources. But still, you know, you've rightly pointed out these are risks. And we're not talking about a few hundred thousand dollars. You're talking about multi-million, billion-dollar investment in these projects. So therefore, some degree of caution would be helpful.
Yeah, just on this note of caution, so recent events, including the flood in Melamji and how that kind of wiped away the intake for the Melamji drinking water project. Year before that, there was another flood in Uttarakhand in a hydropower project that kind of wiped up a lot of that infrastructure. The cost element of building infrastructure on water resources, dams or canals or other stuff, that looks to be going to be significantly more in a climate scenario. right? Or at least this thinking needs to change. I'm not an engineer. You may be best to kind of expand on this, but what kind of departure do you think climate change warrants in the current scope of how infrastructure is designed and built on water resources?
We tentatively discussed some of these aspects, Soumitra, in our earlier sections. But then again, you know, you could look at Chamoli. We all saw the image of how that extreme flood came and then washed away and wiped that, whatever, 400 megawatt system. And then, of course, the smaller one. We had similar event in Pokhara in 2012, I think. A section of the, you know, Annapurna Hill came down, and then we had a massive sort of a inland tsunami, if we will, and that caused lots of downstream devastation. We have similar events in other parts of the hill. So clearly, these extreme hazards have been part and parcel of the Himalayan landscape. And then, of course, these we talked about are fragile areas. Our understanding of the science of climate, its impact on the landscape is, we have some macro understanding. We know how much rain comes, you know, where it falls, the seasonality, the spatial distribution. But we still have much more to learn about the micro impacts, right? So therefore, these micro impacts are where these risks become very evident. You know, as we saw in Melamche, yes, this was a huge investment, but then it was multiple things happening simultaneously. Perhaps rainfall, lack of snow, earthquake in, you know, 2015. And then, of course, what came down was to just that debris flow, which caused tremendous damage. Clearly, these are dots. You know, these are dots that's telling us, hey, wait a minute. You need to be careful. That you need to look at these different indicators, these different responses that you see. Some of them may be natural, but then a lot of it is also because you have not heeded to the specificity, the requirement or the character of the landscape. So that's, I think, is the message. And that, again, takes us back to how we plan, how we imagine, how we design, you know, how we regulate, how we construct, you know, infrastructure in the Himalayan region.
Just a point of interest. So something like Melamche, I don't think anybody saw it coming, right? Or you did. At least for me, I never saw something, an event of that nature unfolding there. So with climate change, you'd expected that extreme events, different sorts of events are going to crop up. How do you plan for these events when you're building infrastructure, thinking about infrastructure?
If I look at Melamche, in the earlier days, there was a lot of debate about relevance of that project or validity of that project. Nobody imagined, nobody envisioned this particular, what do you call?
A mudslide.
Mudslide, if you will. But there were questions about the risk that project of this scale entails. The 26-kilometer tunnel, the reliance on low hydrological data, the financial risks, etc. So perhaps a little bit of a review of the history of planning of this project is necessary. It's just not, you know, something that happened in 2021. That should be our guiding entry point. You know, you also look at the manner these projects are conceptualized. Who are the, I mean, you guys are doing this political economy of bilateral projects. Who are the actors? You know, what was the assumption? What was the grand narrative that kind of defined these projects? These are, I think, also important. And who funded it? How did they really consider the potential risks are important questions as we embark on infrastructure-led transformation development in Nepal. Because that's in the agenda, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, again, I do not deny need for infrastructure. You need better commuting, we need better services, so therefore infrastructure are key. But the way we design and plan have to be different. And that needs to look at the risks that we talked about. We need to look at our standards, our practices. We need to look at our capability, how we manage our knowledge. We need to look at, you know, our rules and regulations.
You have been listening to Pods by PEI. I am Tadan Konsakar, and this is a quick reminder to all of you to do us a small favor by sharing us on social media and leave a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to the show. Now let's get back to the conversation between Soumitra and Ajay.
Moving forward, I just want to zoom out from Nepal and touch upon climate change in the region. Primarily so because we are discussing water resources, and Nepal's water resources is part of the intricacies of South Asia. It creates a lot of interdependencies. So how do you see the impact of climate change really unfolding and expanding these interdependencies that are there in the region through water resources?
Clearly, there is a link. Let's look at snow, for example. You know, there is already a study by Isimon in 2019, which tells us a scenario. And that scenario is that if the business as usual continues, that the emission becomes plus 2 degrees by, 2100, we're going to see 1/3 of the glaciers go. And that's one scenario. Other one is if it's 1.5 degree, it'll be two degrees and 1/3, 1.5 degree. So clearly that means that the rivers are transboundary in nature. And then of course we have the story, the snow-fed river goes, billions of people in the Ganga Basin in Nepal, India, Bangladesh would be affected. And that's true. And we saw that also in 2022 floods in Pakistan. Of course, later on it was riverine flood, but there was Gloth. Mm-hmm. There was also floods in Balochistan and Sindh, area where they don't have that kind of floods. And then, of course, then the flood traveled in the Indus and then, caused this riverine flood. So what does it mean, for example? How do that impact translate to downstream? And that brings us this transboundary element centrally in that conversation should bring. You see, Kosi River, for example, does not flow naturally into India. We have Kosi Barrage. We have Kosi Barrage on which we have a treaty that we signed with India in 1954. So the impact of change in river dynamics is going to be mediated through that structure and that institutional arrangement, which is the treaty. Mm. So when we signed that treaty, climate change was not a concern. In fact, water management even wasn't a concern when we signed that treaty. So we allocate resource. I'm sure you looked at when you did the West Rapti study. We allocate the resource between the two neighbors, between the two countries. And then the resource management is within the territory of that individual country. There is no joint management, you see. Mm. That seems to me is the new conversation we need to do about transboundary management. We do transboundary sharing, but we don't do transboundary management. Same with Gandak, same with Mahakali, the Sarada Barrage. And of course, Karnali, we have no agreement, but there is a barrage downstream at Kailashpuri, which is part of the larger Indian canal network. So what does it mean in terms of changing river flow, changing hydrology? In this treaty regime, we haven't really begun to do the conversation. I'm just currently doing a study on the smaller rivers, these seasonal rivers. And interestingly, you see, when you look at transboundary river, unlike, for example, Indus or Ganga, Nepal has all the rivers generally flow from
north to south,
and our country is from east to west. So we have many river basins, from east to west. We have Kosi, and then we have Konkai, then we have Kosi, then we have Kamala, then we come to Bagmati, then we go to Gandaki, then we go to
Rapti,
Babai, Karnali, Mahakali, and then we have the smaller rivers. We have the Tinau and the Banaganga and the Mona, the Sirsia, the Ratu, the Bering. So this amazing diversity, you see, somebody could call it a problem, but we could call it an opportunity. And each of these rivers, of course,
are transboundary.
And we have not talked about in a meaningful way on, for example, the smaller rivers, the seasonal rivers. The cumulative impact of disasters in these rivers is much greater than the disaster that these major rivers bring. But we don't talk. There is a conversation. They do talk about it. They talk about inundation in the Tarai. But interestingly, Soumitra, we looked at the 50 years of minutes between the two governments, very well kept record of the conversation. They do talk about the floods in seasonal rivers, but the outcome, the product, the solution is always embankment. This is the problem, we will embank. This is the problem, we will embank. For 50 years.
Yeah, that seems to be driven by a different political economy.
Exactly. It's a different political economy, it's different orientation, different sort of, you know, ways you look at the problem. No talk about, for example, you know, livelihoods or forecasting. Forget about gender, you know, forget about gender. It's mostly men of the sectoral agencies, higher level officials of the two countries, mostly engineers. So it's a pretty fascinating sociology that emerges, you see.
Ajay, you've been having this conversation from the past several decades, us very recently at PEI. And clearly, even in a short span of our engagements on the transboundary discourse, it's very clear that you need collective action to resolve some of these issues, including on climate change. Where do you think is the disconnect that we're not trying to kind of forge collective action or work on common goals for the region, not just Nepal and India, but Nepal, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Bhutan? Why isn't there a traction on these common issues?
Well, collective action problems are challenging, isn't it? There is always a contradiction between individual and, you know, the collective. Perhaps that's at work. Again, if you look at history, not that we have not collaborated. We've talked, you know, the Kosi Treaty, the Gandak Treaty, others. You could look at the way the treaties were done, the allocation of benefits, etc. And there is, again, a hegemonic power at play. You know, the downstream power is a hegemonic power. You know, it has better clouds. It is powerful. You know, it is institutionally much more advanced, economically strong, you know, militarily strong. So therefore, this has played into the way conversations and treaties have been done. But I think at the fundamental level, given the challenge that we face, given the challenge of climate change and this risk becoming more dominant, I think somewhere we need to begin to look at, you know, the basis of why we are doing what we do, the foundation of the knowledge. Why is it simply the physical structure that is in our mindset? Why? What guides us? Some of the scholars, you know, in South Asia who've been studying water, look back at the contradictions of the knowledge system. We have considered rivers only as water. We don't think about anything else. We just look at the blue flowing water. We don't consider sediment as part of the system. It's a problem that we want to avoid. Whereas sediment...
But it's never there in the language.
It's never there in the language. It's always a footnote. And then a colleague, a senior colleague, a friend, Professor Jayanta Bandyopadhyay, he says, river is a composite of these four elements. It's water, it's energy, it's biodiversity, and it's sediment. So you cannot extricate these three. You know, you can't take out sediment, biodiversity, and energy and just focus on H2O flowing and then use it to your ends and then assume that everything would be nice. No, that's not happened. So the shift has to begin to recognize these as four important intrinsic elements. And that begins with the knowledge system. The knowledge system is natural science based, technology guided, and what we call reductionist engineering. That's the way that we move forward. The stock and flow water has to be modified. That stock and flow water would meet hydropower, to a certain extent irrigation, and then other needs. It does not consider the downstream. It does not consider the ecosystem. It does not consider multiple roles of water. That's, I think, is the challenge. And we saw that so dramatically in Pakistan, in Indus in 2022.
So just like our previous episode when we were discussing Roundup on COP27 and you talked about the floods in Pakistan being really a factor that moved the conversation towards loss and damage. In that same vein, when you're discussing water resources in the region, do you think climate change is that window of opportunity for rethinking, reformulating the conversation on water management in the region. I see this particularly in reference to how India is positioning itself on the climate discourse. Even in COP27, it was one of the vocal countries, I think, going out to say that there's going to be strong measures from their side and commitments. So maybe climate change is going to provide that language for everybody to come together. Do you think so?
Well, let's look at South Asia first. You know, let's try to look at, you know, what's the content of South Asia. India, Pakistan, Nepal, Afghanistan, Bhutan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Maldives. Clearly, you know, again, in the climate change discourse, India is much more into the global platform in terms of economy and mitigation. It's more on energy. It's more on, you know, for example, decarbonization. It's more on phasing out fossil fuel and, you know, coal and others. And of course, India is a developing country. You know, they have a challenge, you know, like Nepal is a developing country. So therefore, perhaps their priority is something very different from our priority on mitigation. And I think my contention is that we can talk about perhaps energy cooperation. We can talk about other kind of cooperation, but perhaps not from a mitigation perspective. Adaptation is perhaps something that we could talk because the question of vulnerability, the question of risk,
These are shared,
of course. You know, these then cross boundaries. You know, these cross boundaries, political boundaries, administrative boundaries, as well as disciplinary boundaries. So there is, I think, a case for a renewed conversation and a partnership on areas of vulnerability, adaptation across boundary, resilience building, and this larger scheme of things. But then seems to me, you know, Bangladesh is much ahead in these conversations. They have positioned themselves quite well. Pakistan became a champion in COP27 on loss and damage and, you know, on the climate impacts. Again, perhaps in the aftermath of the 2022 floods. India is a big country, is a sort of a large country. There are a lot of innovations going on in terms of responding to climate change. Those are the areas perhaps where we need to begin that conversation, begin that shared learning process. And then, of course, water could be a useful entry point.
On that note, Ajay, we end the conversation. Thank you very much for this very insightful conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Soumitra, for this opportunity. And hope, you know, we try to cover a large canvas, but hopefully, you know, we enjoyed it, and I also enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Pods by PEI. I hope you enjoyed the second part of the conversation between Soumitra and Ajay on the plausibility of Nepal reaching its ambitious goal of net zero emission by 2045 and the impact of climate change on Nepal's water, energy, and infrastructural development. I hope you enjoyed their discussion on the transboundary nature of water relationship in the region and how climate change can perturb the existing interdependencies. Today's episode is part of The Conversations. It was produced by Nirjan Rai with support from Saurabh Lama and Kushi Hang. The episode was recorded at PEI Studio and edited by Nirjan Rai. Our theme music is courtesy of Rohit Shakya from Zindabad. If you liked today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast. Also, please do us a favor by sharing us on social media and leaving a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to the show. For PEI's video-related content, please search for Policy Entrepreneurs on YouTube. And to catch the latest from us on Nepal's policy and politics, please follow us on Twitter at @tweettopei. That's tweet, followed by the number 2, and PEI. And on Facebook at Policy Entrepreneurs, Inc. You can also visit PEI.center to learn more about us. Thanks once again from me, Tadon, and we'll see you soon in our next episode.